Hello, listeners. This is Iris, and we're going to read the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, April 17th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at today's weather forecast. This one is coming from KCRG. The title is Windy with a Shower or Two Wednesday, More Widespread Showers by Tomorrow. The same storm system that gave us stormy conditions yesterday will affect our weather again today. The low-pressure system continues to track away from the region, but it's going to take a bit before it's fully out of our way. As a result, we're feeling windy conditions this morning, with extensive cloud cover in most cases. Within these cloudy areas, some showers have been found too, with the highest concentration of those north of U.S. Highway 20. A few sprinkles or very light showers are possible south of that line too. This shower activity is a bit more favored for the morning hours, with drier air continuing to pour into the state as the low moves away. Thus, the chance should decrease significantly by this afternoon. Skies could actually turn clearer later in the day too, especially by this evening and the first several hours of the night. Temperatures will range from the mid-50s north, where clouds stay the longest, to the mid-60s south, where a little sun may help give us a boost. Winds will be a significant factor for your day again today. Gusts will increase to at least the 30 to 40 mile per hour range between about 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. today. A notable drop in wind speeds is likely tonight, staying relatively light into Thursday as well. After a clearer start tonight, clouds will begin to increase late and showers will be soon to follow. Another disturbance will be passing near the region, bringing a cold front and wringing out the remaining moisture as we head toward the end of the week. Expect showers to move into the western portions of the area around 3 to 4 a.m. tomorrow morning, spreading eastward and reaching most of the rest of us by 6 to 7 a.m. This rain activity, light to perhaps moderate at times, continues through most of the morning, giving us a gray and wet start to the day. Rain becomes more scattered as the day goes onward, eventually exiting by early to mid-afternoon. Total rainfall from this event should range between about 1/10 of an inch to 3/10 of an inch, with a few higher totals possible in areas where an extended period of moderate rainfall occurs. Even with recent rains, this will still help our drought situation in eastern Iowa. After the system exits on Thursday, skies should again turn clearer by Thursday night. Even cooler air will be following the system and will already feel it in most places as soon as Friday morning. Lows then could dip into the mid-30s with enough wind to push wind chill values down into the 20s. A blustery day follows, with highs only in the mid-50s under partly cloudy skies. Saturday will likely be the coolest day of the next several, with highs only in the upper 40s to low 50s. Breezy conditions again stick with us, so wind chills will be a bit of a factor again for most of the day on Saturday. Any sunshine will help offset that, but it will be fighting against the continued influx of a chillier air mass. This reaches its peak on Saturday night into Sunday morning, when lows could fall even a few degrees cooler. This puts much of the area at risk for frost, or even a freeze, potentially endangering plants that have already started growing. If you have outdoor plants, be prepared to either bring them inside this weekend, or potentially cover them if they're especially sensitive to such temperatures. The good news for folks who like a warmer feel to the air is that we should see that return as soon as early next week. While our morning lows on Monday still dip into the mid-30s, highs should bounce back into the upper 50s to low 60s on Monday. A slow climb continues the rest of the week, with readings reaching the upper 60s for many by Wednesday and Thursday. A chance for showers comes with another quick-moving storm system on Monday night into Tuesday, though thunderstorms or severe weather looks unlikely. Now let's begin reading the front page of the Courier. The first article is titled, Camera Regulation Okayed. Bill sent to governor restricts spending, requires permit to place devices. Story written by Aaron Murphy of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. Automated traffic enforcement cameras would not be banned in Iowa, but they would be regulated and their use limited under legislation receiving final approval from lawmakers on Monday. The legislation, which requires local authorities to receive a permit from the state to place a traffic camera, and stipulates how local governments would be required to spend revenue from tickets, needs only Governor Kim Reynolds' signature to become law. That a traffic camera bill is headed to Reynolds' desk is a significant development. Where previous legislative attempts, mostly to ban the devices, over the course of multiple years, have failed. But momentum for addressing traffic cameras built during this year's session, as more of the devices have cropped up across Iowa. Quote, "This has been a long time coming. I think 5 or 6 years we've debated this," Senator Tony Bisignano, a Democrat from Des Moines, said Monday during debate in the Senate. Quote, "We were in such a tie-down of ban or no ban that this came to make sense. There's a need for automated traffic cameras, especially in the urban areas," unquote. As of January, the state's nonpartisan legislative services agency, which provides statistical analysis for the legislature, found 25 cities in Iowa with automated traffic enforcement cameras operating in the 2023 fiscal year. The agency was able to obtain data on traffic camera usage in 10 of those cities. Waterloo had 23 speed and red light cameras at intersections across the city and has been using them since 2018. The city also used 2 mobile cameras. The analysis shows Waterloo issued more than 53,000 citations and collected fines on 49% of those, producing $1.2 million in revenue. Cedar Rapids had 19 traffic cameras, including at 4 locations around the S-curve on Interstate 380, operating in fiscal 2023, according to the agency. The city issued nearly 170,000 citations and collected fines on 55% of those, producing $7.2 million in revenue, according to the analysis, far more than the other cities measured, including Des Moines. According to data from the city of Cedar Rapids, the per-month average of total crashes and crashes with an injury in the city have fallen since the traffic cameras were implemented there in 2010. Among other northeast Iowa cities that had cameras in 2023, according to the agency, were Fayette, West Union, Strawberry Point, Hazleton, Hudson, Independence, and Olwine. Last month, the Waverly City Council approved installation of traffic cameras initially at 3 intersections. Iowa's 377 traffic deaths in 2023 were the state's most since 2016, and the state's 11.2% increase in vehicle-related deaths from 2022 to 2023 was the nation's 4th highest, according to a recent federal report. Under the approved legislation, House File 2681, local governments would be required to obtain a permit from the Iowa Department of Transportation to place an automated traffic enforcement camera on any Iowa road. Existing cameras would be allowed to continue operation until October 1st, but local governments must obtain an Iowa DOT permit to continue them beyond that point. When applying for a permit, the local authority would be required to provide supporting data, including traffic and crash figures, that illustrate why a traffic camera is needed in that location. Cameras could be used to cite only drivers who fail to yield or stop at traffic signal-controlled intersection or railroad crossing, or who exceed the speed limit by more than 10 miles per hour. Local authorities would be required to review and approve a record of the alleged traffic violation captured by a traffic camera before a citation is issued. Cedar Rapids, among other cities, already meet the requirements. Cities with a population of 20,000 or less would be prohibited from issuing fines from violations observed by mobile automated traffic enforcement cameras, equipment installed in a vehicle or trailer parked along a shoulder. Those cities could issue only warnings for violations observed by mobile devices. Local governments would be required to spend post-installation and maintenance revenue from traffic camera citations on transportation infrastructure projects or police or fire department operations. Of the 10 cities for which the Legislative Services Agency was able to acquire traffic camera usage data, 6 send traffic camera ticket revenue to the city's general fund. Cedar Rapids says revenue from its traffic cameras is directed to public safety and was budgeted in fiscal 2023 to fund 33 officer positions, as well as for law enforcement programs and equipment, such as maintenance of police body cameras. Waterloo sends its traffic camera ticket revenue to the general fund to be used for police equipment. Buffalo puts its toward public safety, Muscatine toward police personnel, and Des Moines to its public safety radio system and the Iowa statewide interoperable communications system. Those who have sought to ban automated traffic cameras say their use violates constitutional due process. Quote, "This bill was a good first step. However, it is still my belief that traffic enforcement cameras are unconstitutional and a money grab," said Senator Brad Zahn, a Republican from Urbandale, who has led the charge on traffic camera legislation in previous years, usually in an attempt to ban them, told the Courier, Des Moines Bureau. Zahn voted in favor of the bill, which passed the Senate on a near unanimous 46-1 vote. It previously passed the House at 85-12 vote. Mike Klimisch, a Republican from Spillville, who was the town's mayor for 22 years, said during Senate debate that he believes the legislation establishes, quote, "a very robust regulatory framework that requires local governments to justify the need for traffic cameras." Reynolds's office did not respond to a request for comment on the legislation. This year, in an attempt to secure enough votes to pass his legislation, Zahn combined his proposed traffic camera ban with a proposal that drivers use only hands-free technology when operating a mobile device, a provision that is highly sought by law enforcement officials. That combination upset some Iowans, including advocates for the hands-free requirement, who want to see it passed into law. Law enforcement officials have asked lawmakers in recent years to pass legislation to ban handheld use of mobile devices while driving in Iowa. Officers say the state's prohibition on texting while driving, enacted in 2017, is difficult to enforce because drivers can say they instead were making a call or using the device's GPS, which still is allowed under Iowa law. A proposed hands-free requirement, Senate File 547, overwhelmingly passed the Iowa Senate last year, but the House hit the brakes. Despite data showing the dangers of phone use while driving, Representative Brian Best, a Republican from Glidden, who chairs the House Transportation Committee, said there are not enough votes among House Republicans to pass the bill in the GOP-controlled chamber. Quote, "I'm disappointed. I wish we could have done something with it. But it's just not going to happen this year," Best said. "Maybe next year, with requirements, maybe there will be some different ideologies that come in that might support it." Quote, "But I think there's just a group that kind of felt like there was an infringement on the rights of drivers to be picked up for just having a phone in your hand," unquote. Best, who is not running for re-election, said he believes pressure is mounting to eventually pass a hands-free requirement. Quote, I hope it doesn't take some type of huge tragedy to get everybody on board, he said. Now we have the crop report that's frequently posted on Wednesday. Unseasonably warm weather allows farmers into the fields. Story was written by Courier staff, and the dateline is Des Moines. Dry conditions and warmer than normal temperatures helped Iowa farmers as days suitable for field work increased to 4.9 for the week ending Sunday, according to the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service. And here we have a color photograph showing a sprayer going through a soybean field. And back to the article. Planters have started to roll across the state with the help of a string of warm spring days, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagy said in a news release. Quote, however, there may be a temporary pause in planting, as the forecast shows the potential for severe thunderstorms early this week, followed by near-freezing low temperatures toward the weekend, unquote. Field work included tillage, spraying, applying fertilizer, and seeding oats. Some corn and soybeans were also planted. Iowans experienced unseasonably warm conditions through the reporting period, with positive departures nearing 10 degrees in northern Iowa, according to Justin Glisson, state climatologist with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. The statewide average temperature was 53.9 degrees, 7.8 degrees above normal. While measurable rainfall was reported across most of Iowa, most stations had deficits in the 0.25 to 0.50 inch range. Now, turning the page, we find the Capitol Notebook with an article titled Bill to Arm School Staff Headed to Iowa Governor Reynolds. Dateline Des Moines. A bill that would allow trained school staff to carry firearms on school grounds is headed to Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' office to be signed into law. House lawmakers agreed to a Senate amendment that removed a provision in the bill that would have established a school security personnel grant program that would match up to $50,000 for hiring police or armed private security officers at schools. The state's largest school districts, those with 8,000 or more students, would be required to employ a school resource officer or private school security in each high school unless the district school board votes to opt out. School districts with fewer than 8,000 students would be encouraged to employ armed school resource officers. School districts would not be required to arm staff. Rather, the bill provides requirements for those districts that choose to do so. The measure also provides qualified immunity to school districts and school employees from criminal or civil liability for all, quote, damages incurred pursuant to the application of reasonable force, unquote. Approved staff would be allowed to carry concealed weapons during school hours. It would be up to the districts to decide what firearms staff could carry and whether the district would provide those or allow use of personal firearms. House File 2586 passed 63-36 with all Republicans in support. Representative Matthew Rinker, a Republican from Burlington, joined all Democrats in opposition. The legislation comes in the wake of January's fatal shooting at Perry High School. 11-year-old Amir Joliffe and Principal Dan Marburger were killed, and six others were injured. The 17-year-old shooter died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Supporters of the bill said the fastest way to respond to a school shooting is to have armed personnel on site, trained and available to respond at a moment's notice. Opponents contend arming teachers puts the lives of students and teachers and law enforcement in danger, and warned of the potential for firearms at school to be stolen or misused. Ahead of the vote, a coalition of leading gun violence prevention organizations urged lawmakers to reject the measure, noting most professional education organizations have rejected the call to arm teachers. as have the National Association of School Resource Officers and the American Bar Association. Quote, "It is truly absurd that instead of taking any measures to actually keep our classrooms safe, Iowa lawmakers are instead considering forcing more guns into our schools," said Chloe Geyer, a gun violence survivor and volunteer leader with Drake University Students Demand Action Chapter. Quote, "Iowa lawmakers should immediately reconsider their support on HF 2586 and roll back this foolish bill. If they really want to show they care about kids and our safety, they need to stop before their votes result in more tragedy." Iowa House Republicans are taking another try at regulating diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at public universities, proposing new regulations similar to those the Senate declined to advance earlier this year. The changes are part of the House's education budget, which was set to be passed out of subcommittee on Monday. It includes several policy proposals that House lawmakers already passed as individual bills this year, but stalled in the Senate, in addition to more than $1 billion for Iowa's education system. The bill would ban universities governed by the Board of Regents from establishing or funding DEI offices for any reason not required by federal or state law or accreditation standards. The rules would apply to Iowa State University, the University of Iowa, and the University of Northern Iowa. The bill defines DEA as, in part, quote, "any effort to promote differential treatment of or provide special benefits to individuals on the basis of race, color, or ethnicity." The universities would not be able to hire or assign an employee to perform DEI duties, and they would be prohibited from requiring DEI statements and giving preferential treatment to a person based on a DEI statement. The regulations come after the Board of Regents imposed similar rules on the public universities after conducting a DEI study mandated by the legislature last year. Any funds that would otherwise be directed to DEI offices at the end of fiscal year 2025 would have to be directed to the Iowa Workforce Grant and Incentive Program, which provides grants to students in high-demand majors. Other policy proposals in the bill would require school districts address chronic absenteeism and reinstate a deadline for open enrollment. Representative Carter Nordman, a Republican from Panora, who leads the subcommittee, said the policy proposals, including on DEI, have been the result of negotiations with the Senate, and they have support from the chamber's Republicans. Immigration law worrisome. A group of Iowa police chiefs say legislation signed into law last week by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, making illegal immigration a state crime, will make the job of Iowa law enforcement more difficult. Reynolds last week signed into law Senate File 2340. The law, which takes effect July 1st, allows state officers to arrest migrants who enter the state after having been previously deported from the United States, denied entry to the country, or left the country while facing a deportation order. The legislation was modeled after a Texas law allowing state-level enforcement of federal immigration laws, which is currently being challenged by the U.S. Justice Department and civil rights organizations in a federal court of appeals on constitutional grounds. Federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, have ruled that immigration laws can only be enforced by the federal government. Quote, "The problems at the southern border cannot be solved from Des Moines, Iowa," Marshalltown Police Chief Michael W. Tupper said in a statement. Tupper is a member of the Law Enforcement Immigration Task Force, which seeks to build trust with Iowa immigrant communities to report crimes, identify issues, and establish mutual respect and communication. Quote, "Playing politics with public safety never helps public safety," Tupper continued. Quote, "This law will make the job of law enforcement more difficult. It will diminish public safety because it will cause people to needlessly fear the police. This law has severely harmed community relationships that took decades to build, unquote. Mark Prosser, retired public safety director and former Storm Lake police chief, said Iowa law enforcement has neither the training, staffing, nor resources to involve themselves in immigration enforcement. Quote, this law and others like it will erect a barrier of fear between the diverse populations in our Iowa communities and their local law enforcement, Prosser said in a statement. Biomarker testing bill. A bill that would require Iowa insurance plans to cover biomarker testing when used to diagnose, treat, manage, or monitor cancer and other diseases is headed to Governor Reynolds' desk. Biomarker testing checks for certain genes or proteins that may be linked to certain diseases. Advocates say it could help doctors diagnose diseases earlier. House File 2668 would increase access to biomarker testing, ensure Iowans covered by Medicaid and state-regulated insurance plans have coverage for testing when medically appropriate. Supporters say that would enable more patients to access the most effective treatments for their disease, hopefully leading to better health outcomes, improved quality of life, and reduced costs. The bill passed the House 97-1 on Monday after lawmakers agreed to a Senate amendment to change the definition of when insurance companies have to pay for biomarker testing that has shown to provide meaningful information to guide treatment decisions that can lead to better health outcomes. The definition was changed to reflect language between patient advocacy groups and the health insurance industry. First seven jurors seated in Trump criminal trial. Choosing a jury could take days, proceedings expected to last weeks. The story filed by the Associated Press with a dateline of New York. The first seven jurors for Donald Trump's hush money trial were chosen Tuesday after lawyers grilled members of the jury pool about their social media posts, political views, and personal lives to decide whether they can sit in fair judgment of the former president. The court began filling out the jury of 12 people, along with six alternates, who will decide whether to convict Trump of charges accusing him of falsifying business records to cover up a sex scandal during his 2016 presidential campaign. Possible jurors were quizzed for hours about their views on Trump and other issues, and eight were excused after saying they could not be impartial or because they had other commitments. The methodical process could take several more days or even weeks. The trial, which began Monday, puts Trump's legal problems at the center of his closely contested race against President Joe Biden for the White House. It's the first of Trump's four criminal cases to go to trial, and it may be the only one to reach a verdict before voters go to the polls in November. The trial is expected to last 6 weeks or more. Johnson pushes ahead on aid package for allies. Facing resistance in his party, GOP Speaker will need Democrat support. Story filed by the Associated Press, Dateline, Washington, D.C. House Speaker Mike Johnson pushed back Tuesday against mounting Republican anger over his proposed U.S. aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and other allies, and rejected a call to step aside or risk a vote to oust him from office. Quote, I am not resigning, Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, said after a testy morning meeting of fellow House Republicans at the Capitol. Johnson referred to himself as the wartime speaker of the House and indicated in his strongest self-defense yet he would press forward with the U.S. national security aid package, a situation that would force him to rely on Democrats to help pass it, over objections from his weakened majority. And now, listeners, we'd just like to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, April 17th, on IRIS, That's IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and the print handicapped. Now, let's listen to this announcement.
As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
That's what we were taught, service before self.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
Now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first piece comes from the New York Times, and it's a guest essay titled A Few Words About Nests. And it begins with a photograph. It's a great shot of a pair of cardinals, and they're both in the nest, and they're feeding their two chicks. This was written by Margaret Renkel, who is a contributing opinion writer who covers flora, fauna, politics, and culture in the American South. Spring is proceeding apace in this yard, despite my worst fears. For 28 of the 29 years that my husband and I have lived in this house, the elderly widow next door mostly shared our commitment to a natural yard. And because her house backed up to a little patch of woods, too, between us, we managed to create a miniature wildlife sanctuary. I could sit outside in the springtime and hold very still while a tufted titmouse pulled hairs from my head and carried them to her nest in the yard next door. After my neighbor's death last year, a backhoe demolished the house and nearly all the old trees along with it. I worried about what would happen to the birds now that so many nesting sites are gone. In most ways, it's been a glorious spring anyway, despite the ceaseless hammering next door. The spring beauties and woodland violets are nearly bloomed out now, but already other flowers have taken their place. It will be this way till frost. And yet, all spring, our yard has been bereft of nests. By mid-April, we would normally have bluebirds in the nest box in the front yard, chickadees in at least one of the boxes in the side yards, and Carolina wrens in the pots hanging from the eaves out back. Or last year, in the bag where I kept my clothespins. There's almost always a robin's nest in the cherry tree, a mockingbird nest in the holly beside the driveway, and a cardinal nest in one of the foundation plants. One year, a pair of cardinals nested in a shrub so close to the house it brushed our bedroom window. I left the curtains closed to keep from bothering the birds, but every now and then I would poke the lens of my camera through the crack where the curtains came together. In that way, I watched the female sit patiently on her eggs through cold nights and spring rains. I was watching, too, when both babies took their first flight. Most songbird nests are miracles of architecture and engineering. A mourning dove is a sloppy engineer, but nearly everybody else goes to great lengths to create the perfect nursery. Bluebirds weave pine straw into a shallow cup so perfect you would swear opposable thumbs were involved. Carolina wrens build elaborate domed nests embellished with skeletonized leaves. My favorite backyard nest builder may be the tufted titmouse, who braves the wrath of all manner of mammals to pluck out their fur for most nest lining. Can you imagine a titmouse weighing less than an ounce daring to gather nest materials from the living bodies of raccoons, opossums, dogs, squirrels, groundhogs, and essayists? And yet they do. For the sake of the young they hope to raise safely, they do. This year, there were no nests, at least no obvious ones. I saw a pair of house finches chasing a cowbird out of the yard once, which may mean there's a house finch nest nearby, though I haven't noticed it. And back in mid-February, a pair of bluebirds seemed to be making plans to move into the front yard box, but ultimately decided against it. I finally checked the box last week and found it inhabited by an ant colony. They were house ants, who pose no risk to baby birds, but perhaps bluebirds can't tell the difference between native house ants and invasive fire ants, which are widespread in the South. Whether the reason no ant-occupied nest box in this yard has ever been chosen by house-hunting birds. Fortunately, it's easy to get ants to move their own nest. I opened the box, let the light in, and left them alone long enough to move their eggs to a new site. In this place where developers keep mowing down trees and tree services keep ruthlessly pruning dead wood, cavity nesters have little to work with. I figured the birds would be back within days. So far, no luck. But I was happy that the Carolina chickadees were also nowhere to be found. Chickadees who live here year-round get a head start on nest building, but house wrens who spend the winter much farther south will destroy any chickadee nest they find in territory they've claimed for their own. And in recent years, they have claimed this yard. To persuade the chickadees to nest somewhere else, I never cleaned last year's wren nests out of the boxes. I thought my plan was working. House wrens construct their nets from sticks, and all three of our chickadee boxes still had sticks poking out the bottom. Once, I did see a chickadee emerging from the nest box hanging in the rose arbor, but the sticks told me all was well. Chickadees in this yard have always built their nests out of moss. Then last week, I heard the unmistakable courtship song of a house wren. I can't help rooting for the chickadees, it's true, but I also can't bear the thought of house wrens trying to raise their young in a dirty box, colonized by ants or mites. It was time to remove the old nests. The first box held only the sticks from last year's nest. The second box held an old house wren nest and also a house ant nest. The third box, the one high in the rose arbor, held a mossy chickadee nest, carefully built on top of last year's house wren nest. When I opened the box, the brooding female shot out of the door. I peeked inside. A tiny, bald nestling raised its head and gaped at me. Installing a nest box comes with certain responsibilities. A natural cavity is part of a natural system. But a nest box is a human contrivance, one that sticks out like a sore thumb in a world of soft borders and dappled light. A human being who installs a nest box is obliged to make every effort to keep it safe. During nesting season, I check my boxes every few days to be sure they haven't been taken over by wasps or mites, or to remove any dead chicks. It's even possible to install a wren guard on certain styles of nest boxes, though ours are not among them. I might need to replace all my chickadee boxes next year and move them to new places in the yard, too. I have not heard the house wren singing since the day he arrived. He may have kept flying north. Even so, I won't be checking the chickadee nest again. Right now, it is somewhat camouflaged by leafy rose canes, and I don't want curious eyes to follow me and my ladder right to where it's hidden. I wouldn't know how those baby birds are faring unless I see the remnants of a mossy nest caught in the rose thorns. That uncertainty, the knowing of a very few things in the context of all the things I cannot know, is inevitably the way things are in this yard, and nearly everywhere else too. Are my nest boxes compensating for the loss of natural tree cavities in a city in the grip of convulsive growth? Or are they merely luring defenseless birds to nest in dangerous places? I don't know the answer to this question, and I may never know it. All I know is that there are baby birds in my yard again at last. And, God help me, I will never cease rejoicing. Now from the Des Moines Register, an opinion piece titled, Kim Reynolds Got Her Revenge on Public Education at the Expense of Vital Teacher Training. This was written by Ted Stilwell, who served as director of the Iowa Department of Education from 1995 to 2004. What if your beloved Hawkeye or Cyclone team decided to phase out the weight room and reduce the coaching staff by 2/3. Most fans would find those reductions stupid because our players would suffer a tremendous loss of competitive advantage. We know that athletes, as well as other humans, need good coaching and feedback to improve their skills, and it would take many years to rebuild those support systems if they were decimated. Whether you know it or not, Iowa's governor and legislature just delivered that kind of a blow to the support system for Iowa's teachers and principals. You might not have thought it was a big deal when the legislation that greatly reduced the effectiveness of Iowa's area education agencies passed last month. Maybe you thought the teachers who graduated from a college program for teachers were, quote, good to go for their next 40 years. That is not the case. Why? Teaching involves sets of skills, not just subject area knowledge. If an 8th grade math teacher doesn't succeed, it's not because he hasn't mastered the mathematics. It's because he has not acquired the skills to teach adolescents. There is not enough time in a college teacher preparation program to acquire and to practice all the needed skills. Because teaching has traditionally been a low-paying profession, it would not make economic sense to have a medical school-type preparation where 3/4 of a medical student's time is spent in a clinical setting, typically in a hospital or clinic, with supervised experiences in the environment where they will practice. Prospective teachers get a few weeks of very loosely supervised student teaching, and they get their license. There are teaching hospitals for new medical practitioners. There are very, very few teaching high schools where candidate teachers can practice with coaching. Schools count on access to continued teacher training for necessary skill refinement and for training on better practices, such as the science of reading, better ways to help little kids learn math, how to best use new emerging instructional technology, and other things that could not have been part of their initial training. Good teachers want to get better at helping kids learn, but the research is clear that they need access to training that includes time for practice with coaching and feedback. Online training, videos, and magazines won't suffice for our favorite athletes, and those measures can't be relied on to improve teaching skills across Iowa's classrooms. Both the athletes and the teachers deserve real coaching with feedback. With the right kind of developmental support, average teachers can become really good, and good teachers can become great teachers. With the right support, more teachers become more effective with more kids, and everybody wins. Why is the new AEA legislation a problem? When the governor and the legislature passed the 2024 Area Education Agency legislation, it takes the funding from instructional services and technology in AEAs and gives it to school districts to spend however they choose. While many districts will still use the funds to purchase training from AEAs for the first few years, that commitment won't last through difficult budget times, which are coming soon. When times get tough and money gets tight, superintendents and school boards will have to save dollars by choosing between increasing class sizes or by reducing teacher training. Keeping classes smaller will win. School districts, even the big ones, don't have the capacity for continuing teacher development without AEAs. Eventually, the teachers will suffer, and so will the kids. A support system for teachers that got better and more consistent over 50 years will largely fade away. If anyone writes the history of this decline, it will start with the governor who paid for a phony study to find a way to attack and decimate a part of the public education system that most people did not fully understand. She did it in retribution for public education's earlier resistance to her efforts to provide public money to private schools. She got even, but generations of kids will pay the price. A note about the author: Ted Stillwell served as director of the Iowa Department of Education from 1995 to 2004. He was a teacher and administrator in the Council Bluffs schools beginning in 1971. Next, from the New York Times, we have One Thing Parents Can Control. This was written by Esau McCauley. My father was a long-haul truck driver. He piloted one of those 18-wheelers that had a horn that could raise the dead. As a kid, I longed to join him on his journeys and discover something of the world beyond Huntsville, Alabama, where we lived. Despite his numerous promises, he never took me along. That failure and the addictions of his that defined much of my childhood gave me an education of a different sort. I learned that the world could be cruel and disappointing. Now that I am a father, I struggle with how much of that hard world to reveal to my sons and daughters. I recognize the privilege in even considering this. Parents of children in Gaza and Ukraine do not have the luxury of deciding whether to tell their young ones of evils done and of all the good left undone. Bombs descending from above, indifferent to the innocence of youth, have become their instructors. I believe that we all have a moral duty not to turn away from such suffering. During dinner, my family and I have talked and prayed about war, poverty, racism, and injustice. My hope is that if we install a sense of empathy in our children, they might create a better world than the one we have. It is not just the global upheaval that gives me pause. It is my own mistakes. Not one of us escapes those high-pressure early years of parenthood unscathed. There are always words that we wish that we could unsay, decisions that we would reconsider if time ran backward. What unfulfilled promise will haunt my children? What will they have to forgive? Childhood memories rush upon us, awakened by a smell or a song or certain times of year. The scent of a fried chicken takes me back to my grandmother's house. I can almost hear the crunch it made when I took a bite. Every time I pass an 18-wheeler on the interstate, I remember my father. Fall reminds me of the anxiety I felt when I knew that I had to go back to school without any new outfits or shoes, hoping I wouldn't be mocked. I am 44 years old, and I still remember the hard thumps in my chest. Parents cannot shield their children from the world's cruelty or our failures, but we can try to counter those things. We can provide moments that may become positive recollections to sit alongside harsher ones. I have never understood people who complain about poor families buying a nice TV or shoes or taking their children out to eat. Is it all to be drudgery? Are struggling families not allowed to have dessert? I remember my mother buying us candy at the gas station, having decided that since we were already broke, we might as well take the happiness when we could get it. Since December, my family and I have been abroad while I am on a research sabbatical in England. My 9-year-old son, Peter, a huge soccer fan, dreamed of seeing a Premier League match. He was persistent in the way only elementary school children can be. He arrived in Britain a Manchester City fan, but I couldn't get tickets. When I managed to secure 2 Tottenham Hotspur seats, he immediately switched allegiances. Watching Peter's eyes widen as he approached the stadium, joy emanating from his tiny frame, was like that first ray of light after a downpour. Son Heung-min, who is also a standout on the South Korea national team, is the Spurs star and captain. Our seats seem to be in the part of the stadium filled with Koreans. The red, blue, white, and black South Korean flag and the national pride it represented rippled in the wind beside hot Spur flags. The team itself was gloriously international, with players from Europe, Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and South America, all working together on the beautiful game. For a moment, sport had united us, and my son got to see the world as friendly and good. Between the chants and songs, the crowd was kind to the cute, curly-haired American kid, making us feel as welcome as if we had been fans all our lives. After falling behind 1-0, the Spurs came rushing back to score 3 goals in the final 15 minutes to seal the victory. One fan said to Peter, quote, "Now you have to come back every week to make sure we keep running," unquote. If he could, he would. If I had the power to make every day like that one, no price would be too high. It's hard to predict the impact of these experiences. Parents can only make deposits of joy. We cannot control when our children will make the withdrawals. Did my mother know that I would always remember that one time she took us all to the now-defunct Opryland USA theme park in Nashville? I am not sure what the Hotspur game will mean to my youngest son 2 decades from now. But that day he was happy, and knowing that will have to be enough. Parenting is always an exercise in hope, a gift given to a future we cannot see to the end. At some point, if God is merciful, our children will continue forward without us, left with a memory of love shared and received. We are entrusted with the awesome responsibility of introducing our children to the world and the world to our children. We cannot and should not shield them from all difficulty, but it's also necessary, periodically, to be a bit irresponsible, to spend a little too much time on a soccer game, so they remember that alongside the darkness, sometimes there is light. Come on, you Spurs! A note here about the author. Esau McCauley is a contributing opinion writer and the author of How Far to the Promised Land, One Black Family's Story of Hope and Survival in the American South, and the children's book, Andy Johnson and the March for Justice. He is an associate professor of the New Testament and Public Theology at Wheaton College. Now from the Iowa Capitol Dispatch, Senate sends bill on traffic camera regulation, DOT oversight, to Governor Reynolds. Story written by Robin Opshaw. And the story opens with a photograph of traffic on the freeway to I-235 looking under one of the large pedestrian bridges, and traffic is heavy at the time. And now to the text. A bill regulating, but not banning, traffic camera use by local law enforcement was sent to Governor Kim Reynolds by the Senate with bipartisan support on Monday. House File 2681 passed with 46-1 votes on Monday, with Senator Lynn Evans, a Republican from Orillia, voting against the measure. The bill gives the Iowa Department of Transportation oversight of how Iowa cities and counties implement automatic traffic enforcement systems like the traffic cameras. Iowa local governments and law enforcement would be required to submit explanations as to why a traffic camera is needed at a specific location, including information on the number and severity of accidents, driving speeds, and other potential public safety issues in the area. Along with a camera permitting system, the bill also sets other rules and guidelines around traffic camera use, including prohibitions on localities with fewer than 20,000 residents using mobile traffic camera technologies to issue tickets and speeding tickets for violations that are not more than 10 miles per hour more than the speed limit. The bill would require warning signs to be posted between 500 and 1,000 feet before a camera. Local governments would also be required to use the funds that are collected for transportation infrastructure improvements and police and fire departments' operational costs. Senator Mike Klimisch, a Republican from Spillville, said the bill has been, quote, a long time coming. Lawmakers have considered restrictions on traffic cameras in previous years, but those bills failed to advance, as did a measure proposed earlier this year by Senator Brad Zahn, Republican from Urbandale, to completely ban local governments from using traffic cameras. Senator Tony Bisignano, a Democrat from Des Moines, thanked Klimisch for bringing forward the current legislation that brings, quote, the concept of regulation to the issue and takes a more moderate stance on the use of ATE, that's automatic traffic enforcement systems, by requiring oversight while also acknowledging the legitimate need for these systems. Senator Klimisch said, quote, "I think we've set out a very robust regulatory framework that will allow and actually require cities and municipalities to prove concept, to prove out that they need to have these traffic cameras in these locations," unquote. North Cedar's Dollar General now selling produce after a recent remodel. Story written by Andy Malone, Dateline Cedar Falls. North Cedar residents now have a nearby store carrying fresh produce for the first time in years. Dollar General announced Monday that within the last few weeks, a complete remodel wrapped up and now sells fruits and vegetables at its store at 2921 Center Street. The remodel updated one of Dollar General's older stores. As a result, the company says the experience for shoppers will improve. The store has doubled the size of the freezer and cooler section. It now spans the entire western wall of the store. The company's decision to sell produce at a store, which opened within the last decade, according to Courier Archives, was driven by the lack of fresh fruits and vegetables available in the area. Earlier this year, Dollar General surpassed 5,000 stores nationwide offering fruits and vegetables, and more than 5,400 stores now sell produce. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for this Wednesday, April 17th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.